John Hockenberry here. Thank you for downloading this podcast from WNYC and Public Radio International. You're a very discriminating person, I can tell that. Remember, we're as keen to hear from you as we are from John in Dallas or Joan in Eugene. You can follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway and find out more at thetakeaway.org. Here then, for your listening pleasure, is The Takeaway Podcast. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Oh, to be in Kansas City. We're not really going to be talking about that this hour, but what a baseball series is going on between the Orioles and the Kansas City Royals. Nevertheless, Texas is now once again at the center of the legal and political dispute over a woman's right to choose an abortion. The U.S. Supreme Court has stopped the enforcement of a set of regulations passed by anti-abortion activists, which had closed 13 of that state's abortion clinics. The Supreme Court has blocked the law for now, but there will be a day of reckoning in the court on the legal merits of this case. We will explain. Also, a reckoning on racial justice this hour by prosecuting decades-old crimes. We learn it inhibits the racial reconciliation process in some communities around the nation. We will see that ISIS may be the beneficiary of unfinished and secret business in Iraq regarding weapons of mass destruction. But we begin with the latest abortion decision by the Supreme Court. It blocks a Texas law. It reverses an appeals court decision just a few weeks ago. Joining us now is Adam Liptap, Supreme Court reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Welcome, Adam.
Good to be here.
So in part, this is about abortion, but do you also see the Supreme Court attempting to settle down the consequences of decades of politically charged appointments to the federal judiciary at every level?
That's a big statement. They have been doing a lot of work on emergency applications in the past couple of weeks on elections and same-sex marriage and now abortion. But these cases come to them, particularly in the emergency posture. People make a last-minute attempt to block a lower court decision, and this abortion decision yesterday was one of those.
Does it stand in the evolution of the abortion judiciary narrative over the many, many months, or is this going to be many years, or is this going to be a blip?
It's a signal, but a small one. This is a five-sentence order on an emergency application that sort of just hits the pause button on a huge war in Texas over whether the majority of Texas abortion clinics could be shut down thanks to a law that requires abortion providers to meet some very rigorous requirements. The court will probably, and may well this term, hear the case on the merits and issue a 150-page decision that will give us some real guidance on where we're going on abortion. This early signal is a small one, but heartening to proponents of abortion rights. It looks like it's a little hard to tell because we only know the dissenting people who chose to note their dissents, but it looks like a 6-3 decision with the Chief Justice and Justice Kennedy joining the liberals, and that coalition is one that looks good to supporters of abortion rights.
Is the issue here from the issues raised by Roe v. Wade, or is it more of a general states' rights question here?
The ultimate issue is a follow-on to Roe v. Wade, an elaboration on Roe v. Wade in a case called Casey, which says that states can't put an undue burden on women's rights to seek abortions. And people have never had a really good sense of what undue burden means, but at least some people might think that in Texas, where a lot of women, say 900,000 women, would have to drive 150 miles each way to an abortion clinic, might satisfy that standard of an undue burden.
So this coalition that you describe, which represents a majority of the court, is solidly evaluating this Texas law on the basis of a burden to women, not raising the issue of whether the Supreme Court or state law has the right to force doctors to do one thing or another.
Yeah, I don't think there's any dispute, at least for now, that this is a federal constitutional right. It's the scope of the right we're talking about, but if a state violates a federal constitutional right, it's going to lose because federal law is supreme. But the question of just how much of Roe is left, just how broad the constitutional right to an abortion is the question that this case presents.
If this case is heard on the merits, and if, as you say, there might be a majority strikes down this law. Does this essentially block this channel, this pathway that's developed of creating these regulatory laws within states that affect doctor behavior, doctor practice, that then results in a restriction on abortions? Does it shut that down?
It would seem to shut down these particular channels, but with a caveat. It also matters what the effect of the regulations are. If the regulations are easy to meet or would knock out one abortion clinic out of 50 rather than 30 out of 40, you might get a different answer. And these kinds of regulations, in this case, we're talking about requiring clinics to meet ambulatory surgery center standards and to have abortion-providing doctors have admitting privileges at nearby hospitals. Were the court to knock those down, hard to see that other states could use those. But opponents of abortion are quite creative in the kinds of regulations that they're pursuing, and other kinds of regulations might well pass muster.
What other states might be affected by this Texas decision, as far as you know, and what would be the sort of next act in the abortion dispute if we look at some of these regulatory strategies that you've suggested here?
John, I don't have a list in front of me, but there are easily 10 states that are making various kinds of efforts, including ones trying to limit the use of so-called medical abortions, abortions using drugs rather than surgical procedures. And it's not clear that whatever ruling we get on these, call it doctor qualification kinds of regulations, would affect those others.
Adam Liptak, Supreme Court reporter for our partner, The New York Times. As always, thanks so much.
It's great to be here, John.
This is The Takeaway. This is The Takeaway. Much to catch up on in the continuing conflict in Ukraine, bitter fighting, large-scale demonstrations, and upcoming elections. Later this month, Ukraine will be holding its first legislative election since the ouster of former President Viktor Yanukovych and the election of new President Petro Poroshenko. Meanwhile, since the now dubious ceasefire agreement on September 5th, over 300 Ukrainian soldiers and civilians have died in breakaway eastern Ukraine. Kiev-based reporter Andriy Kulikov with Public Radio Ukraine. Welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me back.
So, Andriy, give us a sense of what's going on in the conflict in Ukraine since we haven't spoken to you for a while as we begin.
Well, the biggest problem now is that people are throwing back and forth accusations that there are those who want war until the victorious end, and they are blaming these people for loss of human life in the east of Ukraine, although we have a lot of proof that there are terrorist illegal formations that are violating the ceasefire regime all the time. But until there's a stable truce, we won't be able to establish for sure who is actually guilty in those violations.
How will that affect the upcoming legislative elections, and will there be a vote all over the country, including Donetsk and Luhansk?
It is hardly likely that people in Donetsk and Luhansk and parts of those regions will be able or willing, for that matter, to vote in the Ukrainian legislative elections. Those regions, well, parts of them, are firmly under control of forces that oppose the central Kiev government and are supported by Russia. And many people there blame the central authorities for allegedly wanting to make war on them. So, on the one hand, Kiev has absolutely no authority, absolutely no control on half of Donetsk and probably one-third of Luhansk regions. On the other hand, many people there are anti-Ukrainian for different reasons. So the voting is going to happen in most of the country, but not in those two chunks of Ukrainian land, and not in Crimea, of course, which was annexed by Russia.
Is there a particular mission or platform of President Poroshenko that he's campaigning on right now, aside from the idea that ultimately there might be restoration of control throughout the country?
Mr. Poroshenko's main slogan is unity. And he says that to preserve, or rather to restore or regain Ukraine's unity, we need peace. He has his own vision of peace, which many people say is a weak position while he yields some territories and some rights to people who are officially called terrorists and separatists. Another point that he tries to build his campaign on is the strategy of reforms called 2020, meaning the year by which those reforms are supposed to happen. And in this respect, there is also a lot of discussion, because people basically do not see any results of proclaimed reforms so far. While mentioning this, we should probably remember that he, of course, as a president, does not run for the parliament, but he has formed quite hastily a powerful party which is called Petro Poroshenko's Bloc, which includes several parties at the moment, and of course there are internal disagreements as well, although not to a major scale.
Kiev-based reporter Andrei Kulikov is with Public Radio Ukraine, speaking to us from Kiev. Thanks so much, Andrei.
Thank you.
I have three young brothers who grew up in the community, who have been told to get out of the street in the same manner as Mike Brown, and that's what compels me to be out here.
Police officer, you're going to have to answer the gun one day.
Oh, police officer,
you're going to have to answer the gun.
We are going to tear down the walls of structural racism,
yes,
and white supremacy in this country.
Voices of protest from Missouri. Some 50 people are now in custody after 4 days of protests in St. Louis and Ferguson, Missouri, stemming from continuing tensions between African Americans and law enforcement. At the center of the protests remains the unresolved death of unarmed Michael Brown 2 months ago by white police officer Darren Wilson. Jelani Cobb is a contributor to The New Yorker, writes frequently about race, politics, history, and culture. He's also the director of Africana Studies at the University of Connecticut. Jelani, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
What are you seeing in this protest? It's gone on now for a while, and there's definitely a social dynamic emerging in the communities that are involved here.
Mm-hmm. I think it's 67 days or so now. And, you know, what's happened, you know, over the course of these, you know, 2 months is that, you know, what started out as a kind of ad hoc vigil and people just gathering at various places in this community has very quickly become an organized and fairly, you know, disciplined operation. And so this past weekend, and part of what people are calling Ferguson October, they organized movements, protests, demonstrations, all over, you know, the St. Louis metro area, and these were things that were not advertised beforehand. So people knew that they would be taking part in activities. They did not know what those activities would be. And then, you know, given social media and cell phones and so on, they were able to say to, you know, where people would be converging at any one point in time. So in addition to the clergy protest that happened in front of the Ferguson Police Department, there were three Walmarts where people protested and temporarily shut down the stores. And there was another protest at the St. Louis Rams game, and there's an ongoing sleep-in on the St. Louis University campus. All these things going on kind of simultaneously.
How would you say these demonstrations represent a split between some of perhaps the ritualized, usual faces, the Al Sharptons of the world who show up at events like this, and maybe new participants at the community level who are taking this in a different direction?
Well, yes, there were some tensions, as a matter of fact, between those two groups. So there are a group of very young activists, you know, with organizations like Hands Up United and Organization for Black Struggle, very locally connected grassroots groups. And they did have some tensions. At a rally on Sunday night, there was some criticism because there were a group of kind of older established figures, including Dr. Cornel West and Cornell William Brooks, is the national president, the new national president of the NAACP, and there were young people who were complaining that they were not on the agenda to speak that day, and these were people who were local activists who were at least a generation younger than some of the people up on the stage, and those tensions spilled out into public, and
You know, what was interesting is that the next day that they almost seemed to not matter because there were all these activities going on all over the place. And at least in terms of executing the demonstrations, it didn't seem to have impeded them.
Well, Jelani, thanks so much for watching this for us. It's been an interesting 67 days there in Ferguson. Jelani, thanks so much.
Absolutely.
Jelani Cobb is a contributor to The New Yorker, writes frequently about race, politics, history, and culture. He's also the director of Africana Studies at the University of Connecticut. We're going to leave you with one of those young voices from St. Louis, Missouri.
For us, this is not an academic issue. Like, and I said this a few weeks ago, the people who want to take the time to break down racism from a philosophical level, y'all did not show up. When the tanks and the armored trucks was there and the tear gas was there and we was getting hit with the rubber bullets and we said, you know what? I can't stay home for this. I can't stay home for this. They killing us. Literally, Missouri is the new Mississippi.
Back in 1964, in some places in America, registering black voters was a capital crime. In Mississippi, among those executed in that year were two white New Yorkers, Mickey Schwermer and Andrew Goodman, along with a black man, James Cheney.
I personally suspect that if Mr. Cheney, who is a native Mississippian Negro, had been alone at the time of the disappearance, that this case, like so many others who have that have come before, would have gone completely unnoticed.
That voices of Rita Schwermer from the PBS documentary Freedom Summer, the bodies of her husband, Mickey, and the two other activists from the Freedom Summer 50 years ago were found weeks after their murders. In Mississippi, violence against outsiders coming to hasten the civil rights movement was tolerated. Only a few of the men responsible for their murder were convicted, and none of them served more than 6 years in prison. In the 1990s, these cases began to be reopened by prosecutors all around the country. Indictments and belated convictions were finally obtained. These trials were a search for justice, but in some communities, it was much more complicated. Renee Romano, a professor of history at Oberlin College, looked at these cases for her book, Racial Reckoning. She says prosecuting crimes of the past has been an important element of achieving racial justice, but she learned these trials cannot absolve communities of all of their sins.
One of the things these trials allow is for us to both explore the past and then we learn about the present by looking at the reopenings. And what we learn about the past, I think, is that violence was really a widespread tool of racial terror. And what we see is that although most of the crimes themselves were committed by a small group of men, often members of groups like the Ku Klux Klan, they were able to continue in their terror campaign because they had the tacit and sometimes open support of politicians, of the police, of law enforcement, and juries that acquitted them if they even went to trial. Many of these cases were never even charged. There were no charges brought. If they went to trial, they were most likely to end in mistrials, hung juries, or in acquittals.
Do you think that some communities in these re-prosecution of cases or even first-time prosecutions of cases are looking for an exoneration, that they are looking for the verdict in these cases to say this could never happen again here now? We're beyond any sense of racism. It's kind of a good housekeeping seal of approval for communities that still do have some reckoning.
Absolutely. I think there's been one impulse for these trials has been to essentially ask for a very easy reckoning. And that's been one of the framings of the trials in the media as well, and by some of the politicians who've come to support them, that by putting this man in jail, we can claim that we have moved on, that we have changed completely, that we have transcended our racist history and our racist past. And also we can really make the argument that what happened in the past doesn't have any more legacies for today. And this is really clear, for example, in Philadelphia, Mississippi, where there is takes decades to get the Freedom Summer murders reopened, the killings of Mickey Schwerner, Andrew Goodman, and James Cheney, a triplet killing that happens in 1964. And Philadelphia had really held out. Other communities were reopening cases, and they had not moved forward. And eventually you get a community group together there that some of the people involved in that community group came forward and said, we need to try this because it's good for business, if nothing else. Right? We need to reopen this case because the reputation that we have as a racist racist place has hurt real estate development, made it hard to attract businesses. So we should do this, if nothing else, as an economic development case. And they really wanted to say, by putting one old man in jail, we have now shown that we are free from this history. And the newspaper editor there who most pushed this vision of an economic development argument when Edgar Ray Killen was convicted wrote an editorial where he paraphrased Martin Luther King and said, we are free at last, free at last. Mm. Thank God Almighty, we're free at last.
Do you think Absolutely. This is a distortion of the civil rights evolution in America, or is this our form of reconciliation? We don't do it the same way they do it in South Africa and other places like Rwanda. We do it mm-hmm. our way, and this is just, you know, where we are at this point on the continuum.
I think it's a distortion, honestly, because what we see happening is the crimes tell a story of systemic racism. They tell a story of broader state and community complicity in racial violence. They tell a story about how widespread and powerful violence was, and also about that depth of history that is going to continue to resonate today. What we get in many of the trials and in representations of them is instead a story of a few bad men who were acting outside of community norms, who people didn't agree with then and don't agree with now, and who by putting in jail, we can say that we have overcome. It is very much not a truth and reconciliation process. A truth and reconciliation process would look broadly at how do we understand the harms done in the past? How do we understand a broader responsibility for those harms? And how do we understand the legacies of those harms for today? And that's not what the trial process is doing.
As you have looked at this history and as I read about it, there's a curious reversal here that's almost chilling when you think about the latent tensions in places like St. Louis and Ferguson, where these mm-hmm. Police shootings produce so much of a reaction. Back in, you know, Natchez, Mississippi and in other places during the civil rights era, the crime was clear. Everybody knew that it happened. There really was no dispute about the objective facts of the crime. It was whether anyone would react that was in dispute, whether anyone would take to the streets that was sort of unknown and ambiguous. Now it's reversed. The expectation is that people will take to the street. It's the circumstances of these police shootings, whether the cop was armed, whether the assailant was armed. That's all in dispute. It's a remarkable, like, 180 reversal.
It's very interesting. At the time, though, in the 60s, in the 50s and 60s, when these crimes occurred, there was some of that kind of questioning. Was this really a crime? There was a lot of blaming of the victims. So when Emmett Till was killed, in his case, that murder case was reopened. They decided they did not have enough evidence to do any new prosecutions, but that murder case was reopened. But at the time, people blamed the killing on Emmett Till. They said he went into this store, he acted outside of bounds, he whistled at a white woman, and that is a really contested story. We don't know that to be true. But he brought it on himself. And at the trial, the sheriff said, well, you know, he was a really well-developed man, essentially, though he was a 14-year-old boy, with well-developed private parts, right, implying that he was a sexual threat who needed to be contained. And so some of the debates that we see today about what went on in particular crimes, they look clear-cut to us now, what happened in the 50s and 60s, but at the time they were contested as well. And I see that actually as a sign of the way race works today, in that all the what is going on in Ferguson and is it about race? Is it about something else? Part of what happens in our society today is it is very hard, I think, for us to see the way race continues to operate. And we've told ourselves as a society a lot of stories about, well, we passed laws and we have a black president and we know that racism doesn't look exactly the same as it did. And so we could say even with some, you know, publicly what happened in Ferguson isn't about race. I would say it's probably not only about race, but to claim that it's not about race in any fashion, as let's say Fox News has done, is just astonishing and is an astonishing willingness to ignore our history and our present.
Renee Romano, author of Racial Reckoning, professor of history at Oberlin College. Renee, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
And at the end of this hour, Iraq, it turns out, still has some secrets.
We finally get cut loose from Walter Reed, and the last words they said to us were, get your purple hearts when they come through, and never came through. We heard they were denied.
That's U.S. Army Staff Sergeant Eric Dooling speaking to the New York Times about wounds from the war in Iraq never acknowledged. We were told back in 2003 that the reasons for the U.S. invasion of Iraq was to prevent the use of weapons of mass destruction by Saddam Hussein. None were found, and it became a towering crisis of trust between Americans and the intelligence services under President George W. Bush. The actual discovery of WMD in Iraq might have helped restore that trust years ago. Revelations now from a new and major investigation by our partner, the New York Times, are even more disturbing. Times investigator C.J. Chivers has uncovered that there were, in fact, chemical weapons, that at numerous points during the occupation, American and Iraqi forces came into contact with these weapons, some even wounded by chemical weapons troops were neither expecting nor prepared for, and everything was kept secret by the Pentagon. Joining us now, New York Times foreign correspondent C.J. Chivers. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
So this is disturbing on so many levels. First, the timing. Second, the treatment of U.S. troops and Iraqi troops, for that matter, and the fact that these weapons apparently are now in control of ISIS, if they exist at all. What do you lay this out for us?
Well, what we found when we started looking at this a long time ago was that, in fact, there were a fairly large number of abandoned chemical weapons in Iraq after the invasion. And these weren't chemical weapons as you would think of chemical weapons, in the sense that they could be used as designed and fired through a artillery tube or multiple rocket launcher. They were old shells and warheads. Many of them had been buried. A lot of them were pitted and crusted, and they pitted and rusted. And they turned up as a feature of what the war became in IEDs and in enemy caches that were being used to make the IEDs. So the troops who were principally responsible for countering these explosive devices and makeshift bombs were now and then over the course of the war, typically while outside on one of the roads or digging through an old stockpile, finding these abandoned chemical weapons and being exposed to them that way.
And you're going to hear now the voice of Andrew Goldman, who's an Army chemical weapons specialist, recounting his making of a discovery just like you describe, C.J. Chivers. Here's Andrew Goldman.
As I'm handing a round up, just an oily, reddish substance just kind of pours out of the round as I'm handing it up to my teammate. And Eric, Sergeant Dooling, said, hold on just a minute. Just as a precautionary measure, we already had one scare today where we thought it was Kim. It was already on our mind. So he went to the truck and got some more M8 paper. And when I tested it this time, it was an obvious positive.
What were the wounds that came from contact with this material?
Well, most of these troops were lightly exposed, and they had suffered a mix of inhalation injuries or burns. And the burns tended to cluster on the lower legs or the upper legs and the shins and the hands. And the reason for that is pretty simple. These shells are big. They're about 40 inches long, 90 or 100 pounds. And when they were picking them up to move them, usually not even aware that they were chemical shells, they would roll them over their thigh to brace them to get a good purchase to stand up with them. And in doing that, some of the chemical agent would be pressed against their leg, or they would inhale some of the vapor. And so they suffered shortness of breath, in one case, nasal bleeding and scarring, and then blisters would pop up usually within hours or the next day on their legs or their hands.
Well, the wounds that you describe here are very, very obvious, it would seem, from a medical perspective. But that leads us to the central mystery here. Why was this kept secret? And that's a mystery that's even expressed by a former Army Colonel, Dr. Dave Edmund Lounsbury, who you spoke with as part of this investigation. Let's listen to him.
If the Allies had found weapons of mass destruction, and more to the point, if Americans had been injured by them, it strikes me as though that might be something you would make a deal, big deal about. These patients would have been celebrities in their own right because they were chemical casualties. But there was no such report.
So, with C.J. Chivers, how do you reconcile that mystery that persists to this day?
Well, you just pointed to the great sadness here, which is that the story had to be written at all. Had all of this information been released and made public in real time, if there weren't for this mix of habitual and reflexive secrecy, then these troops might have been treated well. Their doctors might have been expecting them and not trying to talk them out of their wounds when they showed up at the aid stations and medical clinics. And this whole investigation that we had to do wouldn't have been necessary. And there's ample precedent of the United States in brief instances being candid about this. If you go back and read the Dulfer report of the Iraq Survey Group, which was released in 2004, it all but predicted this, maybe not at the scale, but certainly laid out that it was happening. But after 2004, there really was no more significant disclosure, and it was kept quiet. And I think it was kept quiet mostly out of the habit. I mean, you're talking about a government that will classify the weather report when it's in a combat theater. And it's an enormous game of keep away with information. And so this information was withheld, not just from me and not just from you, but from other people inside the military who needed it in real time.
And the language you use is even disturbing, that there is precedent for the U.S. to be candid in situations like this. How would you assess, and is there anyone assessing, the tactical value of these weapons now if they are under the control of ISIS?
Well, that's a great question. Look closely at these incidents, and what you see is that the people who were wounded were in very, very close proximity. Essentially, they were handling these weapons. These weapons were not used as designed. Their dispersal features didn't work. They were in improvised bombs. It may be that the people who were using them in many cases didn't even know they had chemical shells and thought they were using another typical high-explosive artillery shell as part of their bomb. And so these are not necessarily especially dangerous. They're shocking. They would have an enormous effect if one of them were to be detonated in, say, a shopping mall in the Middle East. There's no question about that. But you might have more effect if you went into that same shopping mall with conventional weapons and explosives and firearms and did the type of terrorist act that we see, you know, with sort of almost like a sad routine around the world. So these are certainly dangerous weapons, but we should be careful about overstating the danger. Most of the wounds that the troops received in Iraq came from conventional weapons, and conventional weapons are doing a pretty horrible job of tearing apart Iraq to this day.
But it's hard to overstate the irony here in that the 2003 invasion to eradicate weapons of mass destruction by Iraq, in fact, has actually helped to proliferate and disperse them, even on the small scale that you describe. C.J. Chivers, foreign correspondent for our partner, The New York Times, thanks so much and great work.
Thanks for having me.
So if you want to catch up on that conversation and look at the details of that report in The New York Times or listen back to anything on the show, you can check us out. Lots to see at thetakeaway.org. You can call us on anything you hear on the program. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. You can register your impossible-to-overstate irony or support. Lots of questions, lots to do. Be a part of The Takeaway community. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Moo.com, offering business cards with Printfinity, the option for a different image on every card in a pack. More at Moo.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.